You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Today, I will be covering the case of Jean Stanford. Jean Stanford was once known as a pioneer woman who not only had a major hand in helping establish the state of California, but was also one of the founders of Stanford University. In 1905, after Jane's passing, many spoke of how Jane's name would be forever inseparably and most prominently linked with the history of California. But that's not what transpired. Instead, Jane's murder was intentionally buried in time, and those responsible were never held accountable. Jane Elizabeth Lathrop was born August 25, 1829, in Albany, New York, to parents Dyer and Jean Ann Shields. She was their third child out of six. Jane had two older sisters and three younger brothers. Jane's parents were said to have raised their children in a very strict household, with an educational pursuit and a strong faith. Jane would be homeschooled most of her life before attending the Albany Female Academy, which back in the day was then considered revolutionary because it allowed girls to seek a higher education. After the Albany Female Academy, Jane would meet and marry a lawyer named Leland Stanford, September 30, 1850. Jane and Leland would move to Port Washington, Wisconsin, where Leland would establish a law practice from 1848 to 1852. A fire would destroy Leland's law library and other property in 1852, at which point Jane and Leland would decide to return to Albany until figuring out what to do next. Leland's brothers had been selling supplies to California gold rush miners in Sacramento, California, and Leland wanted to join them. Some said it was Jane that really pushed Leland to join his brothers, as she had wanted to move to California for some time and saw this as a great opportunity to do that. Jane was said to be quite persistent and vocal throughout her whole life and was never afraid to share her ideas with others. At the same time that Leland and Jane had arranged to leave to California, Jane's father suddenly became very ill, and she felt forced to stay behind with her parents and care for her sick father. Leland would decide to still join his brothers in Sacramento as they had originally planned, leaving Jane with her family to care for her sick father. Friends and neighbors said that the separation from Leland was devastating to Jane, and that many in Albany looked at her as an abandoned wife. In June of 1855, Jane's father would pass, and Leland would return to Albany to gather Jane and their belongings and move to Sacramento, leaving in late 1855. Jane and Leland moved into a modest house in Sacramento, California, and shortly after, Jane's mother and siblings would follow her there. Leland and his family had been very successful in the selling of mining supplies and general merchandise and had built a bit of wealth. When Leland was in California, he became much more active in politics, and in 1862 to 1863 would serve as the Republican governor of California. The Stanfords would decide now that Leland was governor to purchase a much larger house in Sacramento. On Leland's inauguration day, as governor of California, there would be a major flood that struck the area, and Leland would have to travel to his swearing-in by a rowboat. The flood damage was so bad that government offices had to be moved to San Francisco for about 4 months while buildings were repaired. They would return to Sacramento in June of 1862, and Jane would finally get to put her new house in order and begin building her social status within the community. Leland would take the chance to be a major investor in building the Transcontinental Railroad, and he became the co-founder of the Central Pacific Railroad. In 1861, Leland would serve as the Central Pacific Railroad president until 1893. When Jane was 39, she would give birth to her son, Leland DeWitt Stanford, on May 14, 1868. Their son Leland would later be asked to be referred to as Leland Jr. and was their only child. They doted on him and made sure he had the best of everything, from clothing to education. Leland Jr. was the focus of everything that they did in their lives moving forward. Despite being governor and the president and co-founder of a railroad company, Leland would decide to also invest in land in California. He began by buying large plots of land in Northern California that he used to breed horses and grow grapes. Leland was so good and so successful with the railroads that he continued to play a major role throughout California and the Southwest until his death. In 1873, the Central Pacific Railroad moved their home offices from Sacramento to San Francisco. So the Stanfords would move as well, building a new home, a mansion, on Nob Hill in San Francisco, which would be completed in 1876. It would be the same year that Leland Sr. would purchase Mayfield Grange, a 650-acre plot south of San Francisco. In the following 10 years, Leland would focus on buying neighboring farms and finding new methods to breed trotters and thoroughbreds. One of these farms that Leland Sr. purchased, Palo Alto Stock Farm, would eventually become the site of Stanford University. During the 1800s, the Stanfords would travel extensively in Europe, taking Leland Jr. every chance they could. By the time Leland Jr. was in his teens, he told his parents that he had a dream project. He wanted to gather historical objects and open a museum in San Francisco. Leland Jr. wanted to bring all those wonders he was seeing home for others to see. When Leland Jr. was 15, the Stanfords were visiting Florence, Italy, and on their trip, Leland Jr. would fall ill with typhoid fever, and after several weeks of fighting the illness, Leland Jr. would die March 13, 1984, just weeks before his 16th birthday. Leland Sr. and Jane were absolutely devastated at the loss of their child. Since Leland Sr. and Jane were such established, prominent figures when their son passed, newspapers would detail the account of their son's death. Suddenly, a private moment for their family was major news. Not only were friends and family overwhelming them with their sympathy, but they were receiving letters and cards and telegrams from complete strangers expressing their sympathy over the loss of their son. When Jane and Leland Sr. returned from Italy, still grieving their son, they began trying to find a way to keep Leland Jr.'s memory alive. Leland Sr. and Jane would meet with major educators in the Northeast for advice and guidance, and would come to the decision to create a university in California and dedicate it to their son. On November 11, 1885, Jean and Leland Sr. signed a grant founding and endowing the Leland Stanford Junior University. Leland Sr. took on the projects of the construction of buildings while Jane would focus on creating the museum that Leland Jr. always dreamed of. It began with Leland Jr.'s collection, and the Stanfords would contribute some of their own art collection as well. The campus sat along the San Francisco Peninsula and was designed with the specific intention of dissolving barriers between people, disciplines, and ideas. When Jane and Leland envisioned the school dedicated to their son, they wanted to break the norm of what universities offered back then. From the Stanford website, quote, "The Stanfords and founding president David Starr Jordan aimed for their new university to be non-sectarian, co-educational, and affordable to produce cultured and useful graduates and to teach both the traditional liberal arts and the technology and engineering that were already changing America, unquote. Stanford University will go on to make massive, significant developments and changes in our society. It was because of this forward-thinking belief that everybody has something to bring to the table that made Stanford a global success. And many of their graduates are famous, from presidents all the way to engineers and developers that have changed the landscape of medicine, engineering, science, and beyond. I will link their website in the sources and informative links for those interested in learning more about the university's history and their impacts on our modern society. The Leland Stanford Junior University would open October 1, 1891, with 400 students and 15 faculty members. In 1893, just 2 years after opening their university, Leland Sr. would die, June 21st, at the age of 69. With his death and his wife being the only beneficiary since their son had passed, Leland Sr.'s assets were immediately frozen, keeping any income from Jane as well as income coming into the university. The federal government then came to Jane and demanded early payment on loans made to her husband for the Central Pacific Railroad in the 1860s. Afraid that she would lose the university that stood for her son's memory and everything that her and her husband built, Jane would travel to London in 1897 in hopes of selling her personal jewelry collection during Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. Unfortunately, she was not able to find any buyers. In March 1889, 2 years after Jane had done everything she could to keep the university doors open, the United States Supreme Court would reject the government's claims against Leland Sr.'s estates, and in December 1889 would release the assets back to Jane. Now that Jane was confident that she was going to keep the university doors open, she began to have time to focus on new building projects at the university. In 1902, a memorial arch would be erected on campus, and in 1903, a memorial church dedicated to her husband was built, and the museum would get a renovation, making it the largest privately owned museum in the country. In addition, Jane would also add a new library, a gymnasium, and a chemistry laboratory. Jane wasn't always someone those at the university thought were easy to work with, and now that she ran the university, she did butt heads with some staff. It was said that while Jane projected a selfless image, she was also known to turn attention towards herself, even in her child and husband's death. Jane believed she was an instrument of God, set forth to guide her family and society. Publicly identified as being a Christian woman that stood above being a wife and a mother. But the real Jane fought to hide her spiritualism in the beginning of her marriage until taking over Stanford after her husband's death. Being of spiritualism in the Gilded Age was controversial, so Jane played the role required of her to marry a successful husband and to fit into the times until her husband's passing. Now that Jane was the head of an established university, she had the ability to practice her religion not as open, but more open than before. Jane would have a church built on campus in which she could practice spiritualism under the guise of Christianity. Jane was always a believer in spiritualism, but it was widely unaccepted in society, even though many practice it in secret. For those who haven't heard of spiritualism, it's a religion based on the belief that departed souls can interact with the living. Spiritualism began in the 1840s in a small town in New York, but grew very quickly, becoming a divisive religious movement in the 19th century. Many people gravitated towards this religion because, unlike many other traditional religions, it didn't require blind faith and they believed in immortality. This religion also emphasized individualism, which meant at the time it was the only religion that saw women as equal. Jane's church would have many hidden symbols for those practicing spiritualism hidden among the design of the church. If you're interested in learning more about spiritualism and the history of it, I will have a link to that on my Sipping on Some Crime website. In 1900, Jane would establish the first Stanford University scholarship, and a room would be designated and dedicated to Leland Jr. and named the Leland Stanford Jr. Memorial Room. By 1903, at the age of 74, Jane would be persuaded that it was in her best interest and the best interest of Stanford University for her to step down as the head of the university. Jane would eventually relent, and she would turn over the university to the Board of Trustees and remain the president of the board. David Starr Jordan would stay the president of the university. Despite no longer being the head of the university, Jane was involved in every aspect of the university, and that would ruffle some feathers. Jane was determined to stay involved in the day-to-day business of the university and monitor the direction it was going. There would come a point where Jane would begin to question some of Jordan's decisions. She wasn't sure he was making moves that were in the best interest of the university and aligned with her and Leland's original vision. Jane would ask a confidant that was a faculty member, German professor Julius Goebel, to keep an eye on Jordan. Professor Goebel would report back to Jane that Jordan's favoritism and political patronage was beginning to interfere with the faculty's recruitment. Goebel subsequently wrote that she had reached the point of, quote, final remedy, the removal of the president, unquote. There were other staff that brought their concerns to Jane about the direction that they felt that President Jordan was trying to take the university. And Jane was beginning to question whether he was the right person to continue the pursuit of the vision that her and her husband Leland had worked so hard for. I don't know what it was that eventually persuaded Jane to step down and hand over the reins, but she did. And she must have thought it was in the best interest of the university. And just because she wasn't the head of the university anymore doesn't mean that she was going to let go of everything that they had sacrificed and worked towards. It was clear that Jane, who was still the head of the board, was considering replacing or removing altogether President Jordan. In January 1905, Jane was in her San Francisco home and, as part of her evening routine, would drink from a Poland Spring mineral water that had been brought into the room by one of her staff members. This was something that Jane did every night, except this time when Jane took a sip of the water, she thought it had a bitter taste, and she immediately went and forced herself to vomit it up. Jane would ask her maid to try the water for confirmation of the bitter taste, and her maid agreed the water tasted strange. Jane would have the water sent to the pharmacy to be tested, and the analyst would show that the water had contained a fatal dose of strychnine. Jane's maid, Elizabeth Richmond, was the first to fall under suspicion and would be fired. Jane hired her own detective agency to discreetly look into this attempted poisoning incident. This agency would have detectives surveilling Elizabeth Richmond after she was fired, as well as investigating local pharmacies for any large purchases of strychnine. But no pharmacies reported to anyone ordering a large amount of strychnine. Private investigators were also having a hard time finding any evidence that would point to a perpetrator or a motive for the poisoning. Distraught and upset that someone had tried to kill her and trying to recover from a pretty harsh cold, Jane decided the next best move was to embark on an extended trip away from San Francisco, which would include Australia, Asia, and the Middle East. Her plan was to collect materials to bring back home to the University Museum. Jane and her staff would leave from San Francisco for Hawaii February 15, 1905. When Jane arrived in Hawaii at the Moana Hotel, she would meet with her lawyer's wife and friend, Mrs. Hyten. Jane would break down in tears telling Mrs. Hyten of the attempted poisoning in San Francisco and that she could not understand someone's reasoning for trying to do that to her. Jane told Mrs. Hyten that when her water from that night was tested, it had enough poison to kill 20 people. Jane would also discuss with Miss Hyten that night her plans for the university. Miss Hyten said that Jane, during a discussion of spiritualism, said that she believed in spirits and intended to establish an investigation of psychic phenomenon and the university grounds. Jane shared her hopes for the university moving forward and her concerns with Ms. Hyten. February 28th at 10 a.m., Jane and her personal secretary, Bertha, and her maid, May, would go on a sightseeing trip and a picnic. They would stop for lunch amongst a grove of trees, and Jane was feeling great, other than a complaint about a little stiffness after they finished their picnic. After their sightseeing, Jane and her staff would return to Honolulu, where they would stop and look at the Royal Mausoleum. From there, they would head to the Saks Dry Goods on Hotel Street, where Jane wanted to check in on a dress she was having made. All three of them would arrive back at the Moana Hotel by 4 p.m., and Jane would head to her room to rest for dinner. Jane's secretary Bertha and maid May shared a room separate from Jane, which they would retire to rest until dinner. Bertha would accompany Jane to dinner around 6:30 p.m., but they didn't stay long in the dining room because Jane had said that the large picnic lunch that they had eaten earlier had upset her stomach and she was just going to have a bowl of soup. After dinner, Jane and Bertha would walk out on the beach to take in the evening air before returning back to the hotel, where they spent the rest of the evening talking with other guests in the lobby. Bertha would later tell investigators that Jane was, quote, in a good mood and bright spirits that evening and had been all day, unquote. At 8:30 p.m., Jane would return to her room and begin her nighttime routine. That night, as usual, Jane would instruct Bertha to set out a teaspoon of bicarbonate of soda from a newly opened bottle that had been packed in San Francisco, and a capsule of laxative. Bertha would then leave Jane's room and go back to her room, which she shared with May, around 9 p.m. Their room was located right next door to Jane's suite. 2 hours later is when Bertha said she would be awakened by the cries of Jane. Bertha would run into the hallway and find Jane leaning against her bedroom door, holding her stomach, crying out for Bertha and May, saying that she was so sick. The person whose room was on the other side of Jane's room, Adam, heard all the commotion and ran into Jane's room to see Jane standing in the doorway of her room, throwing up her arms, suffering in great pain. Jane begged Adam to get her a doctor. Adam would run from the room and retrieve the hotel physician, Dr. Francis Howard Humphreys, who would race to Jane's room to try to help her. Dr. Humphreys would try to administer a solution of bromine and chloral hydrate. Jane would tell the doctor, quote, my jaws are stiff. This is a horrible death to die, unquote. That's when Jane would begin to seize and spasm, and that quickly progressed into a state of severe rigidity. Her jaw clamped shut, her feet twisted inwards, her fingers and thumbs clenched into a tight fist, her head whipped back, and her respiration plummeted. It was indeed a horrible death. Dr. Humphreys would do everything he could to try to revive Jane, even consulting with several other physicians that he had called to the hotel, but they could not revive Jane. Jane would die February 28, 1905, in Honolulu at the age of 76 from poisoning, according to the doctors that were there and the other physicians that helped to revive Jane that night. They all indicated that she died from strychnine poisoning based on her violent death. Upon receiving the news of Jane's death the following morning via telegram, President Jordan would hastily travel to Hawaii and escort Jane's body back to California. At a press conference about Jane's death and reports that she had died from poisoning, Jordan would tell reporters that Jane had not died of poisoning, not like the stories they were hearing, but of heart failure. This would be the narrative that would be publicly supported by Jane's brother, March 1, 1905, when the news everywhere had become aware of a telegraph sent to the university from Hawaii investigators that stated that Jane had died of strychnine poisoning. Jane's funeral would be held in the Memorial Church on the university grounds March 24, 1905, and more than 6,000 people attended the service. The crowd overflowed into the inner quad, and mourners would follow Jane's casket down Palm Drive to the Stanford Family Mausoleum, where Jane was finally laid to rest between her husband and her son. In Jane's will, she would leave money to numerous charities and relatives, but in the end, she made sure the university received a bulk of the estate. Before releasing Jane's body to President Jordan, Hawaii would conduct a forensic analyst on Jane's drink and perform an autopsy. A coroner's inquest would be called in Hawaii to present their findings. The forensic analysis would reveal the presence of strychnine in the biocarbonate that Jane had taken in her water, and the autopsy would confirm traces of poison in her tissues. The jury would listen to testimony for 3 days before reaching a verdict, which was that Jane Stanford had died from strychnine poisoning and the strychnine had been introduced to Jane's system through the biocarbonate of soda with felonious intent by some person or persons unknown. Both Bertha and Jane's maid May would give statements to the police that the bottle containing the strychnine poisoning was packed in San Francisco 5 weeks ago as part of the preparation to coming to Hawaii, and it remained untouched since then, until it was opened the night prior by Jane herself. By March in California, it would be determined that Jane was the one who purchased 3 ounces of the biocarbonate of soda on February 6th, just 9 days before she sailed to Honolulu. It was purchased from a locally owned pharmacy. Jane's remains would arrive by steamship March 7th. Local investigators in California were speaking with papers denying rumors that there were circulating that Jane's secretary Bertha and her maid May were under surveillance since Jane's death. They made it clear that they did not have any solid suspects yet in Jane's death. Hawaii would turn its findings over to the acting chief of San Francisco, John Spillane, who would receive a cablegram from the sheriff's office of Honolulu stating based on their findings, there was no less than 662 grams of strychnine in the bottle of biocarbonate of soda, which Jane was drinking from the night of her death. The autopsy report would conclude that Jane's official cause of death was tetanus of the respiratory organ, which was a high indication that she was killed by strychnine poisoning. Coupled with the test results of the biocarbonate of soda that Jane consumed that night and the findings of the autopsy, Honolulu was confident in saying that Jane had been intentionally poisoned by someone. There were a few suspects investigators in California were looking at, but only one person was present with Jane for both the attempted poisonings and the actual poisoning event, and that was Jane's personal secretary, Bertha Berner, who had been with Jane for over 30 years. Bertha did everything with Jane, to include joining her when she traveled. Jane trusted Bertha and held her in high regard. In fact, in Jane's will, she had designated that each member of her household staff would receive $1,000, but when it came to Bertha, who had been with her for so many years, she left her $15,000, which in today's amount would be around $100,000. She would be interviewed by authorities and would have to testify at the inquiry, but she would be eliminated as a suspect. Many fingers would be pointed at Stanford President David Starr Jordan, due to the fact that he spent so much time covering her murder up from the public. Jordan also went out of his way to try to discredit the doctors, the autopsy, and the forensic analysis report, basically anything done by Hawaii officials. What officials in California were struggling with was a motive. They needed a motive to be able to narrow down a definitive suspect, and they were not finding one. Hawaii still being so far from the lower 48, especially then, Jordan was able to discredit a lot of what their doctors and officials reported about Jane's death, because in society at the time, those in the lower 48 didn't look at those in Hawaii to be as modern as them. A nice way reporters would put it, instead of just saying they were classist. For the next few months in 1905, there would be different accusations of suspects throughout the press, and President Jordan was working at damage control, trying his best to keep the mention of Jane being poisoned out of the press and far away from the university. From the outside looking in years later, some say it was Jordan's way of protecting the university and everything they built, while others saw it as him trying to cover up and distract from his guilt and involvement in Jane's death. Hawaii got a lot of pushback from San Francisco investigators despite overwhelming evidence that Jane had indeed been poisoned. With Jane's own lawyer standing at Jordan's side and her own brother standing with them telling the press that Hawaii had it wrong, It was hard to keep investigators and the media focused on finding her killer. If you put enough disinformation out there as you do with fact, the lines get blurred, and that's what was happening in Jane's case. A group of San Francisco doctors were formed to look at the full body of the evidence from Hawaii, and they came to the conclusion, based on newspaper accounts, that there was no evidence to prove that Jane had been poisoned, and their opinion eventually became more recognized locally in California over the views of the island doctors who were directly involved with Jane's death, her autopsy, and the forensic analysis of everything in Jane's room that night. Eventually, over time, this narrative pushed again and again and again. Biographical articles and even the encyclopedia would refer to the story of Jane Stanford's death as heart failure. In 1935, Bertha would publish a biography of Jane in which she argued the natural cause theory of Jane's death. Bertha would dismiss any information pointing to Jane's poisoning by denying the coroner's jury, the inquest, autopsy, and forensic reports from Hawaii, and would only quote local-based newspapers from San Francisco that talked about the investigation and the opinion of local doctors to support her conclusion that Jane had died of natural causes. The cause into Jane's death would be made even more difficult to prove poisoning or wrongdoing because in 1906, the San Francisco earthquake would destroy the records in the pharmacy where those specific medications that were tested in Hawaii were bought from. The problem with Jane's case in investigators' eyes was that there were people who would have had the opportunity to kill Jane, but those people investigators didn't believe had a motive. And other suspects who they believed had a motive, they couldn't find when there would have been an opportunity. Over the years, David Starr Jordan, the president of Stanford, and those associated with him and the university would refuse to acknowledge the evidence pointing to Jane being murdered by poisoning, and eventually the case would be forgotten, and no one would ever be charged with the mysterious death of Jane Stanford. The fact that she had no family advocate pushing for her and she was the last of her family to be laid to rest, it was easy to bury this story, especially back then. There is so much more to Jane's story and the investigation into Jane's death. There are hundreds of archived articles that you could dig through, many in the beginning of 1905, from papers all across the country that go more in depth into Jane's relationship with many different staff members at the university, her charity work, and her determination to make society a better place. There are many articles that talk of Jane's connection with spiritualism and wanting to bring that to an acceptable part of society, her love for completing her son's dream of his museum, and so much more. If you're interested in learning more about Jane's case, there is so much out there. Thank you all so much for taking the time to dive back into history with me. I think it's so important that somebody tell Jane's story, and more people are. If you're listening on Apple and Spotify, please don't forget to hit that subscribe and leave a review. That helps cases like Jane's get to more ears. And don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit like, share, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.